of course related to the word megaleh, to reveal. And that idea is developed in many different ways. But on a simple level, the Megillah is really written on two planes. There's the way the non-Jewish world reads the Megillah, I'll elaborate in a moment. And there's the, if you will, the hidden code that Mordechai and Esther plugged into the Megillah that was for Jewish eyes only. The Ibn Ezra, in his introduction to Megillat Esther, asks the famous question that everyone knows the famous answer to, but Ibn Ezra gives a different answer. Why didn't the name of God appear in the Megillah? One would expect that a recounting of a miracle should be written in this classic biblical style, Vayhi Bimei, etc., and the Jews acted improperly, and there was a terrible decree, and God got angry at the Jewish people, and then the Jews did tshuva, and God saved the Jewish people. That's the regular model that we find in Tanakh. That's the model that we even find in post-Tanakh, like the story of Hanukkah and the various recountings of that story. Sefer HaMakabim, so the name of God does appear. How come it doesn't appear in the Megillah? So the famous answer is... What was that? Is that an answer? Anybody know the famous answer to why the name of God doesn't appear in the Megillah? Go ahead. That the name of God didn't appear because it wasn't obvious that God was intervening. And the whole Gilui, if you will, the Megillah, to be Megaleh, is the fact that really God was there. However, the Ibn Ezra writes, Al Derech HaPshat, that perhaps the reason that Mordechai and Esther, who wrote down the Megillah, did not include the name, because they knew that this scroll, which they were sending out to Sheva Vesra Meya Medina, V'chol Medina, Medina, etc., to all the 127 countries and all the Jews in the 127 countries, it would become part of the Persian historical record. Esther was the queen. So, and when they would write it in the historical Persian records, that it would take the names of God, Yudke Vavke, and they would substitute the name of whatever, the Persian Avodah Zarah. And that wouldn't be kavod for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that what was originally written as the Almighty should be some worthless idol. So they wrote it, knowing that the Jews would know that God was behind the scenes, but that the Persians shouldn't disgrace the name of God by doing that. The other answer is more popular, but I believe the answers are interrelated. Because you have to, since, as Ibn Ezra writes, that this scroll that we read on Purim was going to be read by non-Jews as well, including Achashverosh, so it had to be written in a way that would include various inner dynamics that really was going on, that wouldn't make Achashverosh look too bad, but nonetheless should be written in a way that the Jews, when reading between the lines, will be able to see the true story. That's what seems to emerge from that Ibn Ezra. The fact that it was going to become part of the official record meant that there was a need for Mordechai and Esther to write the Megillah on two planes. The revealed plane, or if you will, the Midrashic plane, that when Jews study it carefully, so we see all kinds of hidden meanings, all kinds of Giluyim, Megillah, to reveal that is behind the scenes. On a simple level, that helps explain, although not all the commentaries explain this, why Achashverosh seems to have been duped into killing out a whole nation. We have, of course, in Perek Aleph, Perek Gimel, right? So we have Perek Gimel on page 2, Pasachet. Vayomer Haman l'melech Achashverosh, yeshno am achad mefuzar mefurad bein amim. Right, there's one nation among all the other nations. That's the Sei HaMelech in Amosim. They don't follow the laws of the king. V'lamelech ein shavel anicham. And then Pasach Yud. V'yosar HaMelech et habato me'al yedo v'yitno l'haman agit zorer ha'yudim. Vayomer HaMelech, ha'kesef nasun loch v'am lasot bo katov v'necha. Do whatever you want. With whom? With a non-nation that he never identified? How many are they? Maybe you're lying about their lack of obedience to the king's laws. on a simple level, it must have been that Ahasuerus was informed who they were. That's a famous medrash that Chazal say that like two neighbors, one had a mound in his field and the other one had a pit in his field. So the neighbor with the mound in his field is complaining about the mound, that it's he's bumping into it all the time. And the one with the pit is complaining about the pit, that I'm falling into it all the time. So then they come up with a bright moment, the light bulbs go on, and said, hey, wait a second. Like, there used to be a commercial for Reese's Pieces, some were chocolate bar and some were peanut butter, and somehow they crashed into each other, and out came Reese's Pieces. So wait, why don't you take your mound and put it in my pit? Great, now we'll all be happy. So that's what the Medrash comments, that was the attitude of Ahasuerus and Haman. They both wanted to get rid of the Jews. And this way they'll both be able to satisfy their desire. My Rebbe Rav Goldlicht in his beautiful sefer called Asufat Marachot. Yeah, right here. He has fantastic drashot. He was the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Keren B'Yavna, Rechaim Yaakov Goldlicht Zatzal. So he had a whole fantastic idea, which I don't remember, why for one the Jews were like a mound, and why for one the Jews were like a pit. He says, when you read Midrashim, you always have to analyze the precise analogy. So Chazal clearly assuming in that Medrash that Ahasuerus was in on the whole plot. But then suddenly, when we get to page 3, Esther says, Perek Zayin Pasuk Dalet, Kinim Karnu Ani Vami Lashmid Larog LaBeid. Right, we're being destroyed, and this is terrible. And Pasuk Hei, V'yom HaMelech HaShvirosh, Yom HaLester HaMalkal, Mi Yosef Ezehu. Hashem Allah Oli Bola Soskin. Who wanted to do such a crazy thing like that, to wipe out a whole nation? Vav, Atom Rester Ish Tzar Voyev, Haman HaRazeh. What do you mean, Haman HaRazeh? Ahasuerus was in the plot. Well, I guess you could say on a simple level, yeah, but he didn't realize his queen would be a Jewess. Now he figured, okay, let's forget about killing the Jews, let's save the nation of the queen. But if Ahasuerus was in on the plot all along, it's hard to imagine how he could suddenly turn his back on Haman when he agreed to it all along. And if he wasn't on the plot all along, how come Esther and Mordechai wrote it down in a way that it sounds like Haman didn't identify the nation? So based on it, Ibn Ezra, we could understand exactly why they wrote it that way. They couldn't make Ahasuerus look bad. Otherwise, Esther would have her head handed to her. So they wrote it in a way where it looked like Ahasuerus was duped. But the reality is that he wasn't. Now, I agree that not all the commentaries agree to that. Some commentaries assume that Ahasuerus was actually duped. But the simpler reading seems the other way. Chazal have machlokas about that, whether Ahasuerus was a melech tipish, whether he was a fool, was manipulated, or whether he was a melech chacham, and he was an evil man. Many other sub-readings of the Megillah that can be explained, again, based on that Ibn Ezra, that because it was going to become part of the historical record, so they had to write it in a way that only Jewish eyes would be able to see between the lines and see what was really going on. That there were really two Rishoyim who were trying to destroy the Jews. And one decided to betray the other one in order to save his queen. We mentioned earlier that the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not appear in the Megillah, again, either for the Ibn Ezra's reason or for the other famous reason, that's the hidden miracle. So many of you have probably heard this, I just wanted to show you inside, maybe for those who haven't, that one would have expected that at least let's have some allusions of God's name in the Megillah. And indeed you do, and there are traditions already from the Rishonim, that there are various words that have Rashei Tevot or Sofei Tevot, either the first letter of each word or the end letters of each word that spell out the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes directly Yudke Vovke, sometimes backwards, sometimes out of order. The Rabbeinu Bechai, for example, in his a student of the Ramban, in his commentary on the Megillah, in a sefer called Kar HaKemach, so he lists all of the references, and he also analyzes why sometimes it's forward, sometimes it's backward. So I just wanted to show you some of them. If we, some of the more famous ones. Let's start from the beginning. You'll see in Perek Aleph, I highlighted them on the computer. So here you have Perek Aleph. So you have not the correct order, but you have Yud followed by a Vav, followed by the two A's at the very beginning of the Megillah. It's not an order, Yud Kei Vav Kei, but according to the Midrashim and Alpi Kabbalah, there are many permutations of God's name. Each thing means a slightly different aspect, but it's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name. There you have the letters of Yud Kei Vav Kei. And then you have concerning Vashti's crime. We know that God was in on that too, to rig it, that Vashti should be bumped off so that Esther could take over. And Pasuk Tzayin, you also have the letters of Hashem's name, Yudke Vavke. Again, that's Vavke Yudke, but also the letters. Then you have again at the bottom there, in reverse order, Yudke Vavke and Pasuk Chof. Keeps repeating itself. And then the more famous ones, if you turn the page to page 2 on Perek Hey. Here already is the beginning of Esther's counterplot to try to undo the scheming of Haman. So not surprisingly, we see that Esther was assisted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yovo HaMelech VeHaman HaYon, Yudkei Vavkei. Which is an allusion to the fact that Esther is also praying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should be involved. Then in the Pesach Yud Gimel, backwards, V'chol Zeh Einenu Shoveli, Yudkei Vavkei. And then finally in the page 3, again, at the top of the page, you have, this is the second time that, this is Haman coming into while Achashverosh was up in the middle of the night. So again you have Yudkei Vavkei, where Hashem is making that happen. And then finally the downfall of Haman in page 3, lower down on page 3, Ki chalsa elov hara'ah, that Haman saw the gigs up, that's it, he's going to have he's going to swing. Ki chalsa elov hara'ah, the sofei tevot ar, yudkei vavkei. I think that Rabbeinu Bechai writes that when you have the Shem Hashem at the end of a word, it implies midas adin. So that fits exactly in that spot, because Haman obviously had the din thrown at him. Yeah, some Balei Kriya, when they read the Megillah, they read these words with a special niggin. In order to indicate that there's a remez. I even saw just this year, went to Ilchus Megillah at different times, but I saw one of the commentaries write, there was a minig of Sofrim who would write the Megillah, they would write it the way I wrote it here. They would highlight the Yudke Vavke to note that it's there. Then the Achronim say you shouldn't do that. That's, we have no solid tradition to do that, but even to that extent, was people would actually write it differently in the Megillah to note that. So the Shem Hashem really does appear in the Megillah, but it appears in a hidden way, either to allude to that very important theme of Purim, the hidden miracle, which is of course relevant to all of our lives, you have to open our eyes and see, or in order to protect the sanctity of the Divine Name, that it shouldn't be translated, Chalila, into some kind of a Avodah Zarah. So what I'd like to do, with those words of introduction, to try to see some of those hidden aspects of the Megillah that our illustrious relatives, if you will, not necessarily ancestors, but wrote very cleverly to try to teach us all of these meanings. Something we're not going to go into, because it's out of my league, but there are many Mefarshim, such as the Vilna Gaon and others, who explain that the Megillah has a whole different reading. That has nothing to do with the Purim story. Al Derech HaRemez, that it has all kinds of Kabbalistic secrets in it, and a lot of very deep ideas, which makes sense. Esther was a Neviah, Mordechai was an enormous Talmud Chacham. So you have not only ideas within the storyline of hidden meanings of the Megillah, but we have a tradition that the Megillah includes many, many meanings that are way out of this world that have nothing to do with the Purim story. Much as Lahavdil is true about the Torah itself, that the Torah tells us stories, gives us mitzvos, and they're all true on a simple level. But the Torah, as we know, has injected into it many, many meanings that are way beyond the simple meaning. I think the Vilna Gaon wrote 4 commentaries on Megillah Esther. One Al Derech HaPshat, one Al Derech HaDrash, one Al Derech HaRemez, one Al Derech HaSod. If I'm not mistaken, I think. Certainly 2 or 3, but I think he actually wrote 4. Okay, so let's begin our journey. Some of what I'm saying, I'm sure many of you have learned, but I'm including it anyway, just to review, and perhaps for those who haven't. So, everyone is familiar, or hope will be familiar by the end of what we're saying now, of the fact that the Suda of Achashverosh, on a surface level, is because he's solidifying his kingdom. right? That he was king for a while, and now he's trying to solidify it by having everyone party, and this way they'll, hail to the chief. But on a deeper level, Chazal teach us in the Gemara Megillah, Pasuk Gimel, Bishnas Shalosh L'Malcho, why did he pick the third year of his reign in order to make a Suda? And if you look at Pasuk Zayin, V'ashkot b'chlei zahav v'chelim mikelim shonim, the Balkore reads that with the Nigan of Eicha. V'chelim mikelim shonim. What's that all about? Sure, many of you have heard this before. Chelim of Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara Megillah even says that Achashverosh wore the begadim of the Kohen Gadol at this meal. Why is he suddenly getting, taking a visit to the Machon HaMikdash all of a sudden? Why is he doing that at this meal? So what's the approach that you've learned? Go ahead. Exactly. So this is the famous countdown. Yirmiyah said that there was going to be 70 years of the Golas Bavel, but it was unclear from Yirmiyah's words whether that was going to be counted from the rise of Nebuchadnezzar to power, or perhaps from the first exile that happened toward the end of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash 11 years before him, or perhaps from the actual destruction. So the Beis HaMikdash was actually rebuilt 70 years after its destruction. But Achashverosh didn't know that. Very interesting in terms of we were teaching in the class on Mashiach that just like in Mitzrayim, it was a big mystery, 400 years. But those 400 years didn't turn out to be exactly 400 years. They were counted from a different date. It was only 210. Same with the final exile. That the final day is a very big mystery. Only God knows exactly when he's counting it from and when it's going to end. So Achashverosh thought erroneously that this is the time that the Jews are not going back. Very interesting. It's hard to see this because the New York Times doesn't say it, and the Wall Street Journal doesn't say it, and the Hamariv doesn't say it, and even Arut Sheva doesn't say it. But the world knows deep down that when the Jews are going to have an elevated state in the world, when they become the prominent nation, so then the non-Jews are no longer going to be prominent. And Chazal teaches us that the hidden dynamic of anti-Semitism is because in the subconscious, if you will, at least, of the non-Jewish nations, they realize that there's a battle of values here. There's a battle of Kiddusha, of Torah, of bringing the message of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the world, both for Jews and for non-Jews, and the forces that want to destroy all that, which of course are referred to, generally speaking, as the villain that we'll read about this Shabbos, Amalek. So Achashverosh and Haman, very interesting. What do they care about the Beis HaMikdash? If they have armies, then they'll be powerful anyway. Why are they so happy that the Jews are down? Rome made probably the most glorious victory march in Rome till this day. It's one of the few complete relics left from the Roman Empire, the Titus's Arch of Victory. You know, you see murals of it in various museums here in Israel. The Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash are depicted. They were so thrilled that they destroyed the Mikdash and they destroyed the Jews. They even made a coin, a Judea Capta. You know, the famous picture of a palm tree with the widow who was supposed to represent the Jewish people. They're so elated that they put the Jews down. Well, Rome captured so many nations. Why were they so exhilarated for destroying the Jews? Because they knew there's some of this spiritual dynamic. They read their Bible stories, Yaakov and Esav, twins, when one's up, one's down, La'omi, La'omi, Amatz. So Achashverosh sees that if it didn't work out, the Jews are not going back. Okay, so they're totally defeated, and therefore I'll be able to be king. I'll be able to have dominion over the world. Because if the Jews are going to come back, then I'm not going to be able to have dominion over the world. Even though, as we all know, the Jews, as the Rambam writes so beautifully at the end of Hilchos Melachim, the Jews wanted to be up, not in order to have dominion over the world, but in order to bring Kedusha to the world. But the nations of the world somehow intuit that, yeah, but they're going to foil our plot here. We want to just do whatever we want. Helps explain a lot of the inner dynamic between the Sinas Yisrael and the two planes. Sinah of Jews and Sinah of Medinas Yisrael. that appears in the world, because there's this inner dynamic, whether people are aware of it or not, but in the subconscious, they realize that the Jews have to be down in order for us to be up. So Achashverosh is making a big party, because he thinks that the Beis HaMikdash, and ultimately symbolizing Jewish sovereignty, and also total connection to God, so that's going to ruin their sovereignty. And that's why you have that inner dynamic, which many of you, I'm sure, have heard of, that Chazal understood that Achashverosh's generosity, if you will, to Esther, I'll do whatever you want, Queenie. I'll give you up to half the kingdom. So on a simple level, it just means, you know, half for me, half for you. What did Chazal say about that? Archatzi HaMalchus V'Seyos? But not the Beis HaMikdash. He didn't even know that she was Jewish yet when he was saying this. He says, but not the Beis HaMikdash, because that, if that's going to be built, that's going to represent Jewish, like a seesaw. The Jews are up, then I'm down. So that I can't do. I'm not going to forfeit my kingdom over my love for you. So that's one main theme that we have in the Megillah, that this festivity here was really a celebration of Jewish defeat. And now we go a step further. And as you all know, if a terrible decree that only happened twice in Jewish history, once which was, with the help of God, was totally unsuccessful from the perspective of our enemies, and one we know that, unfortunately, was largely successful, even though, Baruch Hashem, we're here to tell the tale, a decree to kill every man, woman, and child. It happened 2 times in history. There's even a Hasidic tradition that the decree of Haman, it wasn't repealed, it was delayed. That somehow, in terms of our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so Hashem had rachamim, and he delayed that decree. But that decree came back again in our own century, the century before, to come back to not destroy the Jewish people, but unfortunately wreak tremendous havoc on the Jewish people with a different instantiation of Haman. So we know that if there's a decree against Klal Yisrael, that we did something wrong. What did we do wrong? So, what are the famous answers? I'm sure you've studied this before. What, you read the Megillah, it doesn't look like anything went wrong. Go ahead. Okay, that's the most famous answer. Shenehenu misudoso shel Achashverosh. Now, why didn't Esther and Mordechai write that? Why didn't they write? And the Jews went to the Suda. It doesn't even say the Jews went to the Suda. And they violated appropriate separation, if you will, from the nations of the world. And therefore, the decree happened. Why did Mordechai and Esther write it that way? If that's really what you'd expect in Tanakh. That's what Shoftim speaks about. V'yasu asara v'eini Hashem, etc. And then there was a threat. And then they were saved because they did tshuva. So, again, according to the theory we put forth, why didn't Mordechai and Esther write that? Because if they would, that the Jews acted improperly because they partook of the meal of Achashverosh. That doesn't make Achashverosh look too good. Right? That the Jews are like, they have to separate themselves, they can't assimilate. So they had to just make an allusion. As it says in Pasuk Hey, right? Asa melech lechol ha'am anim tzim b'shushan. All the people in Shushan, including the Jews. And then, as the famous Rashi quotes from the Gemara in Megillah, Pasuk Chet, Vashsiach ados eino neis. No one was forcing anyone to drink non-kosher wine. Get glad kosher. Make a deal with the OU. Make a giant mevushal. It'll be fine. Don't worry. Whatever you want. Kichen yisara melech lasos kirtzon ish va'ish. Chazal comment, who's ish v'ish? Kirtzon Mordechai, Kirtzon Haman? Mordechai insisted on having kosher food, even though he was against the whole meal, but at least let's have kosher food. So again, this hidden dynamic. So now, but let's put it together. So what were the Jews doing by participating in this meal, besides the fact that they were fraternizing with the idolatrous Persians in a way that might lead to assimilation? But what was the meal about? It was about the defeat of the Jews. So by the Jews participating, what were they saying? We're Persians. What a terrible echo that has, you know, to subsequent generations. We're Germans. We're Frenchmen. Right? As the famous slogan of one of the unfortunate founding fathers of the Reform movement, even though he never meant to found it necessarily, be a German in the street and a Jew at home. Your primary loyalty is to your nation in which you live, and only the secondary loyalty, you do the Jewish stuff, you know, privately. That's not who you are. Who you are is you're a German, you're an American, you're a Frenchman, and then, you know, you do the Shabbos and the Kashrus, you know, when it doesn't interfere. That's not what we believe in. We believe we're Jews first, right? Not a Jewish American, but an American Jew, right? Not a Jewish Frenchman, but a French Jew. Not a Jewish Israeli, but an Israeli Jew. So this is the enormous crime, the assimilationist meal that the Jews partook of. And it was ein ones, they partook of it willingly. Apparently they had an option to say no. So that led to this terrible decree. So I saw a beautiful pshat just going in here from a commentary I never heard of before, Rav Shmuel de Ozida. Maybe Avia, you'll put it on your sign. Who is Rav Shmuel de Ozida? Okay, the fish is more interesting, but okay. So Rav Shmuel de Ozida has the following pshat. We see that when Mordechai is told by Esther to decree a fast for three days and three nights. Where does it say that? Perek Dalid, at the end, second column there. Pasuk Zayin. Lech kenos es kol yudim anim sim bishushan v'tsumu alai v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim laila v'yom. Very interesting. 3 days, night and day. So some say it means they ate a little bit at night in order to be able to give them strength for the next day. But the simple meaning is no. This is a 72-hour fast. Like stretch the limits of human endurance here. Because the decree was enormous. It was to destroy the whole Jews. Never had they encountered such a decree in their whole existence. What does Esther say? Sumu alai v'al tochlu v'al tishtu. What's problematic with that pasuk? I just saw this year. Sumu alai means fast. And what do you do when you fast? Eat pizza. You don't eat, you don't drink. So this is what I like to call the yashikoach pshat. Sumu alai al tochlu v'al tishtu yashikoach. And I was, of course I know what sumu means. So Rav Shmuel de Ozida and others say as well, what is Esther telling them? This is tshuva here. Sumu alai, v'al tochlu v'al tishtu. Never ever again, commit right now to never again join an assimilationist meal to indicate that you're not part of Am Yisrael, that you want to be part of the Persians. That's the illusion. Again, an illusion, because they can't write that explicitly. Sumu alai, that's the not eating and not drinking. Now, al tochlu v'al tishtu, don't ever violate again what led to this decree. And that's indeed what Klal Yisrael accepted. That's what Chazal tell us. Worms are very, very my Rebbeim taught me, and I'm sure you've learned this as well. Purim, of course, you know, it's a festive time, and people are a little lighter, and they have all kinds of shtick, but one shouldn't forget the mainstay of Purim. It's an enormous day of divine rachamim and ability to connect to God. That's what, I forgot his name, the speaker here on Tuesday, is trying to go into a little bit of that inner depth of the fact that on Purim we reconnect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem expresses His unconditional love for us, and we have to plug into that. So, my Rabbi Shechter pointed out that we really have 3 days of Matan Torah. One is Shavuos, one is Yom Kippur, when we got the second Luchos, and one is Yom Kippurim. That's another pshat on that idea. Purim, it's a day of Matan Torah. What was the Torah given? So, if you look at the very end of the Megillah, and page 4, Pasuk Chof Zayin, at the end of the first column there, it says, Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, aleihem v'al zaram, v'al kol nevim aleihem. So on a simple level, what does it mean? They accepted upon themselves to keep Purim. But on a midrashic level, the Gemara in Shabbat tells us, Kimu mashikivlu kvar. They recommitted to that which they already had accepted. They already accepted the Torah at Har Sinai. Now they accept it again. What does Kabbalah HaTorah have to do with Purim? But if we understand how it all started, the sin was that we were abandoning Torah. We were saying, Persians first, then we do the Jew stuff on the side. That's basically an abandonment of Torah. We want to blend into the society at large. And the tikkun was, no, we're Jews first. Kimu v'kiblu Yehudim, they realign themselves to Torah Hashem to once again become proud Jews. And that, of course, was the kapara for the atonement for this terrible sin that had been committed. Okay, that's one major theme I wanted to give over. Now just a few quickies. So the Malbim points out that if you look very carefully, I love the Malbim. The Malbim Gevaldik. Yes. And, sometimes he has some things that are a little out of the ordinary, but he always has such enormous insights into the text. So we look here, easily missed. Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, Lehavi et Vashti HaMalko lefnei HaMelech beketer Malchut. Right? That Achashverosh wants to bring Vashti the queen. Okay, what does it say in Pasuk Yud Bet? Vatima'ein HaMalka Vashti. And Queen Vashti refused. Pasuk Yud Aleph says, Vashti HaMalka. Pasuk Yud Bet says, HaMalka Vashti. Why? So here again, there's an inner dynamic that Mordechai and Esther, with their cleverness, could not write explicitly, because it makes Achashverosh look bad. As you all know, Achashverosh and Vashti were engaging in a power struggle. Vashti was a granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And Achashverosh was a commoner who rose to kingship, some kind of coup that he pulled. So he married, probably against her will, right? One of royal blood to kind of legitimize his kingdom, that he's usurping now the Babylonian Empire, which was taken over by Persia earlier, but by marrying into the Babylonian line, he was giving a certain validity to it. But now, he feels he's strong enough to be a king in his own right. And he wants to show, Vashti, you're just my, pardon the expression, you're my concubine in a certain sense. Right? Yeah, you're queen, but I'm the boss here. You're not really the Malka, you're a Malka, because I'm the king. So what does he call her? Vashti HaMalka. You're Vashti, whatever, a name. You're HaMalka because of me. And what does she say? Well, excuse me. You're a nobody. I have royal blood. I'm HaMalka, Vashti. If anything, you have a right to royalty because you married me. So it's alluded to. Again, of course, Mordechai and Esther couldn't write that in explicitly. But what a clever trick. And then, I believe I heard this first from Rav Rivlin, the Mashgiach of Keren Biavn, is also a master darshan. So when we go further, so it says, Perek Bet, Achar Adrim Eila Kishol Chamat HaMelech, no, excuse me, a little earlier, Yudalid. Karove love, etc. All the officers that he's consulting with, what should he do to the queen now that she refused? And in Pasuk Tetvav it says Kidos Malasos Bamalkov Vashti. Wait a second, I thought Achashverosh wants to put her down, so then he should say, what should we do with Vashti Amalka? So I think the Malbim explains that at this point Achashverosh is looking for an out. On the one hand, he still wants Vashti around because she legitimizes his kingdom. But on the other hand, he wants to punish her. So he wants the advisors to somehow give him an out. Right? Let's somehow, I don't know, put her in jail for a while. I don't know, have her cook cholent every day. Something that will punish her, but won't eliminate her. So he calls her Malka Vashti. After all, she's Malka. So take it easy on her. And what happens? Memuchan says, no, off with her head. Again, it was alluded to. Right? That she shouldn't see the king anymore. And Achashverosh couldn't say no, because then he's going to look bad. So he kills her, but he really didn't want to do that. And that's why he gets upset about it and ultimately had a grudge against Memuchan, which ultimately played itself out later. Chazal say Memuchan was Haman because he bumped off his queen that legitimized his kingdom. Esther, with all of her greatness, but she wasn't of royal blood. I mean, we know she was, but not the kind of royal blood that he was looking for. So that's one also dynamic in terms of this power struggle between Vashti and Ahasuerush. I have a vart that's a little modern, but I wanted to share it with you. Food for thought. Maybe it's because I went to Yeshiva University, but okay. But I think it might also be a certain message in the Megillah. We have this very strange decree that comes out of Ahasuerush's court, if you will, based on Memuchan's advice. It says in Pasuk Chaf, one second, where do we have this? Yes, Pasuk Chaf, V'nishma pisgam ha-melech asher yaseh b'chol malchuso ki rabohi, v'chol anashim yitnu yekar levalehen l'migadol v'ad katan. That all the women should respect their husbands. Okay, interesting decree. I guess based on the fact that Vashti disobeyed the Ahasuerush, but now you have a whole decree that the women should listen to their husbands. Okay. And then in Pasuk Chavet, Vayishlach Sarim al kol medinot ha-melech, al kol medinot, etc. Liyos kol ish sorev reveso. That the man should be in control in the family, and with a berakel shon amo. Very strange. So some want to say that that was part of the divine machination here, that Mordechai probably would have tried to hide Esther, that she shouldn't be taken away. A nice Jewish girl shouldn't be picked as the queen of some non-Jewish drunkard. But since there was a decree that the husband runs the show, so what are you going to say? I don't know where my wife is, so I don't know where Esther is. What do you mean? You run the show. She can't go anywhere without you. So that wouldn't enable Mordechai to hide her, because that's what's one of the Achronim suggests that that was part of the miracle, that Mordechai couldn't hide her because he wouldn't be able to claim that I don't know where she is because he's supposed to run the show. Well, we look interesting. The Megillah takes, a little later, takes the pains to have the following two psukim, that Mordechai told Esther not to reveal her identity. I guess he felt that it would be in handy sometime later to play the fact that she's Jewish, but meantime to keep it hidden. And what does it say in Pasuk Chaf, in Perek Bet, page 1, second column? Ein Esther mageret molareta vetama, kasher tziva le Mordechai. Esther did not reveal her birth nation as Mordechai commanded her. Vetma mar Mordechai, Esther also. Esther followed what Mordechai said. Kasher hoisa be'amnoito. When she was with him, according to Chazal, she was his wife. On pshat level, she was his relative that he was raising. That she was obedient to Mordechai. She listened. And then you have a pasuk later, on page 2 again, when Esther Hamalka tells Mordechai to gather all the Jews. So at the very end of Perek Dalet, it says, Vayavor Mordechai, Vayas kichol asher tzivsa alav Esther. Esther tells Mordechai, gather all the Jews and have them fast for 3 days, so my going to Ahasuerush should be successful. And then it says, and Mordechai did in accordance with everything that Esther commanded him. Aren't these redundant psukim? Esther did it. She listened. She didn't. She didn't reveal her that she was Jewish. Why does the Megillah have to say as Mordechai commanded her? Because after all, Esther listened to Mordechai. And then when Mordechai tells the Jews to fast, because after all, Esther told him to do that, and Asher Tzivsa Alav Esther. So it just hit me a few years ago that maybe the Megillah is trying to contrast. There was a silly non-Jewish decree that came out that there's a rule. You always have to listen to the husband. And what if the husband is wrong? That's the law. So that's stupidity. That's a mentality of the husband should lord it over the wife because the husband's always right. And what's the Jewish mentality? Whoever's right. Whoever's saying proper things. So when Mordechai is telling Esther, don't tell, And there was no reason for Esther to doubt that that was something improper, so she obeyed Mordechai. And when Esther comes up with this brilliant tshuva idea, so then Mordechai does exactly what Esther says. Kasher tzivsa, love Esther. Who should be followed, the husband or the wife? Whoever's right. That's the Jewish attitude. Emes, not some abstract idea. Whatever the husband says, or whatever the king says. Chazal tell us, if a parent tells us to violate the Torah, so out goes Kibud Av V'Em, so you can't listen. If a king tells you to violate the Torah, you can't listen. If a husband says something that's inappropriate, so the wife doesn't listen. And if the wife says something that's very appropriate, the husband should say, well, I'm the boss here, not you. The Torah teaches you have to listen to what's true. And that's what we need. We have throughout Jewish history. Sometimes the husband came up with a brilliant idea. Sometimes the wife did. Miriam gets Amram to remarry Yocheved. Come on, kid, you're only a girl. Leave me alone. What do you know? She's speaking the truth. And that's what we're supposed to do. Yeah, I don't know. Food for thought. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm too modern. But I think there's a diuk here with the tzivui, and that's a direct contrast to the stupid decree that came out, that no decree, the husband's always right. Why? Why should that be? Sometimes the wife is right. Okay. Everyone's familiar with the famous idea of the Tavshin Zayin, right? The illusion, the mysterious illusion in the names of the children of the sons of Haman. You have on page 3 and 4, right? You have a little letter Shin in Parmashta, right? Everyone knows this? A little letter Shin in Parmashta. We'll go quickly. At the end of page 3, you have a little letter Tof in Parshandasa, and then you have a little letter Zion in Vayezasa, back on page 4. So that spells out Tof Shin Zion. And then there's a big Vav. Vayezasa, right? So there's a famous Hasidic Rebbe, I wish I could attribute it, I don't remember which one, that in 1946, I think in November of 1946, that was already Tov Shin Zayin, because the calendar already clicks at Tishrei. So that's when 10 Nazis were hanged. Very mysterious, because when one of them was going out to be hanged, so he screamed out Purim Fest, 1947. No one really noted it, except it made it into the pages of Newsweek. I don't know why he said this. And then there was a great Hasidic Rebbe who said, ah, got the remez. Because for many, almost 2,000 years, Mordechai and Esther already had alluded to that. There's going to be another Purim Fest when the enemies of the Jews are going to be hanged up. 10. There were actually 12. And one Nazi, his sentence was commuted from death to life in prison. And one committed suicide in jail. So 10 went to the gallows. So someone had to explain that maybe that was the hidden meaning of why Esther Amalka mysteriously says, can you give us one more day to kill the enemies in Shushan? Why did you have to kill kill our enemies in Shushan? To kill the enemies of the Jews, right? That's why we celebrate Purim in Yerushalayim on Monday. Because in Shushan, they had one more day of warring against their enemies. Why did you need that? So I guess you could say, oh, Derech HaPshat, she felt that unless they're going to do that, that the enemies will start up again. But I think many point out, based on this idea, that Esther was davening for the future. Yeah, I forgot to mention before, many of you probably heard this, that we have a Midrashic tradition that sometimes it says Vayhi Bimei HaMelech Achashverosh, and most of the time it just says HaMelech. So anytime it just says HaMelech, there's a dual meaning. It's a Achashverosh on a Pshat level, but it's also a Kodesh Baruch Hu on a Drash level. Some of them are easier to see. Again, what was the name of the speaker? Nili's brother? Benji Epstein. So he had that beautiful idea about V'tova ani beinav, I'm tova and Eini HaMelech, referring Eini HaMelech HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yovo HaMelech V'Haman, according to this idea, is not just Melech HaChashverosh, it's Esther is begging for divine assistance. So when Esther Amalka says, can you please give us another day to destroy our enemies, that with her enormous Ruach HaKodesh, she was looking into the future, there was going to be another Haman. And she's saying, will you please have Rachamim then also? And indeed, although the Jewish people suffered miserably from that, they lost a third of their population. But the plot of Hitler did not succeed. The Jews are still here and regenerating and reverberating and continuing Beruchnius and Begashmius, and all the more so. That's why I can almost bring you to tears that just recently, I think last year, so Baruch Hashem, the number of Jews living in the Holy Land crossed the 6 million mark. What a significant mark. Again, Baruch Hashem, there are many more Jews in the world besides that. What a significant idea little more than 60 years after the plot to kill all the Jews, so that number was crossed again in the Holy Land that Hitler also was trying to destroy. Okay, just one final idea as we come to the end. If you look at the end of Perek Dalet, so it says Vayava Mordechai. On a simple level, what does Vayava Mordechai mean? That he went from place to place. It also seems to be a strange pasuk. What would be the regular way to say that Mordechai went to the Jews to inform them? Vayelech Mordechai. What's Vayava Mordechai? So Chazal say Ovar. He violated a Torah law. What was the Torah law? So we have a tradition, as I'm sure many of you heard, that when were the 3 days of fasting? Pesach. The night of the Seder was suspended. They have a kid's book on Purim, so they have little cartoons or whatever, so there's a big sign there in one of like the shuls they have, you know, in Shushan, that instead of the Seder, we're going to have a tshuva gathering in shul, and we're gonna say Tillim all night, something like that. Vayava Mordechai, he violated the Torah, meaning there was no Seder that night. So the Mefarshim ask, why did they have to schedule the fast days on the night of the Seder? The decree was yet to come. They had approximately a year. So schedule it right after Pesach. So I heard a vort from Rabbi Newman. Who's Rabbi Newman? You never heard of Rabbi Newman. He's a guy in Kew Garden Hills. He's Baruch Hashem, a well-to-do Baal HaBayit, always kaveit in the Torah, and he's full of fire. So anytime he saw me, like, grab me by my shoulders and say, Rabbi Haber, I have to tell you a vart. And then he would tell me the vart, and then he would dance away with it. That's a vart! No, that's a vart! You never heard a vart like that in your life, did you? So here's a vart that you never heard like that in your life. I don't know who originated it. It wasn't Rabbi Newman, but it always stuck with me. Here's what Mordechai and Esther are trying to do. We have a principle that for emergency measures, you're allowed to violate the Torah. So here's the emergency measure. The Jews are about to be destroyed. So Mordechai and Esther were trying to tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we know we sinned, Chatanu Avinu Pashanu, but you know what it's going to be in the world without Jews? You know what the world's going to look like without Jews? No matzah, no Haggadah, no secret tears with Mitzrayim, with all, so to speak, kiviyachol, the divine pleasure that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has when we perform his mitzvos. No Korban Pesach, nothing. None of this is going to happen. So with all of our averos, we're still okay, no? Im tova ani beinav, we still keep the Seder, we still recount your praises, we still give you nachas ruach avinu sheva shamayim. So they dafka picked a day, so to speak, that would really shake up the heavens, so to speak. No Jews, nothing. No Pesach, one of the highlights of the year. And of course, b'chasdei Hashem, Hashem answered our prayers. It's also a lesson in terms of our not taking these things for granted. We have on our Geshmak Yom Tov of Purim, a Geshmak Yom Tov of Pesach, that was all in the risk and all in the balance that we wouldn't have it anymore. And Rebbe Chvatzol Yamel Yehudim, the Nafuchu, that everything was turned over and our enemies were destroyed. We got back our Yamim Tovim, we added another one, the famous holiday of Purim. Belo Yavor Mitocha Yehudim, as you all know, as Benji Rabbi Epstein pointed out, that even in the Imos HaMashiach, those timeless messages of Purim, of Kabbalah Satorah, of remaining proud Jews and of being excited about everything that we do in terms of our Avodas Hashem, remain with us forever. Meaningful fast, and a Freilich and Purim to everybody.
Thank you.
Enjoy. Thank you for listening. Isn't that a vort?